Welcome back to the final Behind the Lens of 2024. The final Behind the Lens to close out 10 years of shows. It's a big day. I never thought in a million years that I would be here, you know, 10 years ago when I started this show. Oh, well, thank you, Pam. That's been sitting there, and she never uses it. My God. So she used it. I never would have believed that we'd be here 10 years later. Over 700 live guests have either been in studio or called in. Over 750 pre-recorded interviews. We've had Oscar winners, Oscar nominees, first-time filmmakers, artisans, producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, VFX gurus, composers, film editors, sound mixers. We have had the greatest assortment of guests on this show, either live or pre-recorded, over the past 10 years. And all but a couple of them I truly love and have appreciated. but yeah, I mean, so today is a big day. And by the way, in case you didn't realize it, I'm Debbie Elias, creator, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens. So who knows what will happen in 2025. You'll have to check out social media over the next couple weeks to find out what's going on with that as we wrap up 10 years today. I'm very excited about today's show. But before I get into my wonderful special guest who's joining us at the midpoint of the show, I just have to give a huge shout out to some very specific publicists who have kept me flowing with live talent over the years. Annie Jeeves at Cinematic Red PR, Karen Oberman, Tim Binder, Kim Dixon. Kim, I love you. You have been an amazing friend for, 30 years now, if not more? But they have, and everybody at my A-team at Ginsberg Libby, you guys are all, I couldn't do what I do without you. And to other publicists that don't give me the right time of day, poo on you. But no, seriously, you guys are just head and shoulders above the crowd. And of course, a very, very, very dear, dear friend, Clint Morris, who stepped down from October Coast. And I send all my love to Clint in Australia. He has moved into another venture, and he's going through a few challenges right now, health challenges. But Clint has been a very big part of the past 10 years of Behind the Lens radio show. So to all of you guys, I thank you so much. And to all of the talent that has been on the show and keep coming back on the show, Simon Phillips, Frank Meyer, Colin Cunningham, just to name a few. I'm so appreciative for all of you. So adding to the appreciation tour today, joining me at the midpoint of the show is a dear friend and filmmaker, John Corcoran. John and I have known each other, I think it's been more than 20 years now. I have watched him and been on this ride with him all this time. And he's written scripts, he's had options, they've fallen apart, has survived COVID, has fought and battled as a writer, made it into the writer's room for Snowpiercer, actually co-wrote episode 8 of the final season, which aired a few months ago. And now he has his very first short film, proof of concept film, that is on the festival circuit now, Sky Forest. going further than John as writer-director of that. His cinematographer and editor is Jordan Johnson. Jordan used to shoot this show when we were shooting video before Big Boss Nick put in a Mevo, whatever this thing is, that I detest. Because it makes everything look weird. But Jordan used to shoot the show. Jordan shot some red carpets for me. And to see Jordan's growth as a cinematographer and an editor is fantastic. Charlie McNulty. Charlie, one of the producers of Sky Forest. Charlie has been here in studio twice about books he has written. His Giggle Stick coloring book, which is hilarious, and I think it's still available on Amazon, and if you haven't gotten it, you should. And his limerick book. So for me to have John on here today, it's like everything comes full circle. And John is the kind of filmmaker that is the core of the heart of Behind the Lens. This is what prompted me with the conception of the show 10 years ago, is to welcome filmmakers. Let them talk about their journey. Let them talk about the process of making their new film that's out. What did they, working with cinematographers, what are they thinking of with visual grammar? What are they thinking of in terms of editing, music, the challenges of casting, those hurdles, the learning curves? Those are the people that I really want to help. I really want to showcase, in addition to the big names like Greta Gerwig, who was here on our show, Frank Stallone, who was here, just Lisa Ann Walter, who was here in studio. Just an amazing, amazing. It's been an amazing ride for 10 years. So we'll see what happens come 2025. But before we get to John joining us today, it was a big decision what pre-recorded interview to air today, but I'm going with my exclusive interview with Jack Houston talking about his feature film directorial, Day of the Fight. This is, there's no split decision on this one, folks. It is a knockout. Jack has proven his weight in gold as a director. The cast is incredible. Michael Pitt, John McGarro, Ron Perlman, who is dynamite. Steve Buscemi, Joe Pesci, Nicolette Robinson, Cameron Williamson. And it is basically, it's a character study. It's shot in black and white. And it's the story of Michael Mikey Flanagan, a once celebrated boxer, had some infractions with the law, ended up in prison, now is out of prison and is about to fight for the first time since leaving prison. And what we look at is essentially a day in the life, a redemptive journey through the streets of Brooklyn as Mikey reconnects with those he loves the most in his life and trying to right the wrongs of his past as he goes into this fight. And Jack has done an amazing job by writing this story about a boxer. He is paying homage to his grandfather, the legendary John Houston, who was a boxer in his youth, a champion boxer in his youth. Just on every level, John has just checked all the boxes. An amazing job working with his cinematographer, Peter Simonite. Just brilliant work. His editor, Joe Klotz. Production designer, Peter Zimba. And one of the most beautiful scores of the year, Ben McDiarmid, who I just happens to be, I think, Jack's brother-in-law. You know, the Houstons, they got to keep it all in the family. We got John. We got great-grandfather Walter. We've got Aunt Angelica and Uncle Danny. And Jack's father is actor Tony Houston. Everything from Jack's life comes together in Day of the Fight. It is an amazing film. It is in theaters. I cannot encourage you enough to see this film. This is a storyteller. So I'll shut up. And without any further ado, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Jack Houston talking Day of the Fight.
Hi, Debbie.
So, hello, Jack. How are you?
I'm good, Debbie. How are you?
I am so happy to be speaking with you again. It's been so long since we last chatted for, it was either Ben-Hur or Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what a treat to speak to you again. 7 years.
Jack, the treat is for me. I have to tell you, your grandfather right now would be so proud, and wherever his spirit is now is looking down and smiling. You have been wasting your time in front of the camera, my friend. You belong behind the camera as a director and writer. This.
Oh, you're just so sweet. Oh, my goodness.
Jack, this film is amazing. On every level. Your work with Peter Simonite on the cinematography, Joe's editing, Ben's scoring. And this all just buttresses the beauty of the performances. But at the core, you have this great story. It's a character study. A character study of a man who happens to be a boxer. And it's really interesting. And I also love you picked a boxer because that's a nod to your grandfather. Because I know he boxed in his youth and was a champion. So that touched me right away. Knowing that going in.
Oh, that's the point.
You craft this so beautifully, putting us into the black and white and shades of gray world. So choosing monochromatic black and white with Peter was brilliant. Brilliant choice on your part. Because you can really play with those shades of gray. And that's what we get in Mikey. Shades of gray of his life. But you set the tone so quickly that we know he's a great guy the minute we see him with his cat. And then giving
lovely you pick up on that. That's so true.
And giving the little girl his coat. Cinema fans who might go into this thinking, okay, it's a boxing movie, you have touchstones like that that they'll recognize from the character of Rocky Balboa, because Stallone did something very similar in giving Rocky a heart. You give Mikey a heart here with those little touches. Breaking this all down, where did this start for you? Because this, on every level, is just, I am blown away by it, Jack.
Oh, I'm so touched by your comment. I mean, that means so much to me. And it's amazing how much you picked up on. It's funny. I think the seed was planted from my work with Michael back doing Boardwalk, where I used to watch him punch a sandbag and go off to the boxing gym most days, and also just being opposite him and seeing him what hard on the exterior, but he has these eyes and this depth into his soul, which is so sensitive and so vulnerable and childlike in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's innocence to Michael, which I always felt like I wanted to capture in some way. And when I came up with the idea for the movie, it's funny, you know, those moments where you can't imagine anybody else but Michael in this role.
Yeah.
I wanted to make something exactly what you just said, which isn't a boxing film. It's a film about a boxer, about a character. It's about the human condition, about those relationships, making something relatable. And it's funny that you brought up, the cat and the girl. I said, you know, you can always tell a good person if animals and children like them.
That's it.
Like they're dear to him. They instantly are drawn to him, both. And I wanted that from the beginning. Even the way you write, dear Sasha in the beginning, he misspelled deer. It's like he's a child himself.
Mm-hmm.
And like kids, he's done some bad things, but he's not a bad person. And I think the world right now is so polarizing in that aspect. You know, it's just, there's always, you know, between, you know, there's so much hate and there's not enough love and coming together. And I wanted to really tell a story about somebody who had done some, you know, had made some wrong steps in their life, but that didn't mean they're a bad person. The people that really matter are far more willing to forgive than you might expect. And it's about, what if you only had one day? If you had one day, what would you say? Who would you say it to? And who would, what would you do? I really wanted to play on that. And I wanted to make something that's just full of heart, like something and follow a character that you can actually fall in love with.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're missing that in cinema right now a lot. I think we're missing those great old films, the films from the past that made me fall in love with cinema, made me want to make movies, were because we watch and witness something unfold in front of us where we fully, fully invested into a character. But by the end of it, you are taken on a journey and you do witness, you know, all the ups and downs, all the lights and shades. And like you said, that's what black and white does for me. I think it's a magnifying glass to the soul. I think it is playing on that. So, you know, I was trying to include everything that you said was right.
I mean, Jack, it's just this personal journey that we go on, self-acceptance, redemption, and it's rooted in kindness and great sensitivity. And it's not just what Michael brings to the character of Mikey with sensitivity, but we get John Magaro's work as Father Patrick. And I have to say, that scene in the church, as Mikey is leaving, and then you and Joe Plotz, you hold that shot for an extra beat.
Oh, that's my favorite shot in the movie.
That is...
When he leaves?
Yes, and he turns...
Oh, my God, and John's sitting there, and he doesn't know that Mikey's looking at him?
Yeah, just...
Oh, my God.
I got chills.
Breaks my heart. Oh,
I got chills with that. You have characters like Father Patrick, Steve Buscemi as Mikey's uncle, Joe Pesci as Pops, and, of course, Ron Perlman... is just beyond reproach here, and really, it just gives so much. He is the father that Mikey longed for.
Yeah, the one who actually felt the love from, you know.
But as we watch the film play out and get into that third act, the love from Mikey's father really was there. He just couldn't articulate it.
He couldn't say it, and we actually added it, so... It's amazing you said, because, you know, that song is Joe singing, that what we put on, that's one of Joe's songs, and that's actually Joe singing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's why it's so amazing, is actually Joe's has one of the most beautiful voices. And I wanted exactly that, which is when my grandmother was suffering from early onset dementia, she would hear music and it would pull her back in the room for a second. She had these moments of lucidity based on, like, the music would almost pull back memories. And, you know, that moment with Joe, and he says that line, which is, you know, as a kid, I used to pretend you wrote this song for me, which was all I wanted. What he's saying is all I wanted, you know, because the song is If I Ever Lost You, all I wanted to hear was I love you, and his dad was never able to say it, but I say that this one moment when he leaves the room and you just see Joe's face,
mm-hmm.
and it's just on the brink, and you realize he remembered everything.
That's another incredibly powerful shot that you've got. But now you brought up the singing. Well, I'm going to bypass cinematography for a moment, jump into the score and your needle drops. Ben's score and the instrumentation with a lot of strings, violin, some viola and cello, when we get into the second and third act, as well as piano, it really articulates and exemplifies the beauty of isolation and the internalization that Mikey is going through, set against the brutality of the sport of boxing and the sport of life. It knocks you down and you got to get back up. And that juxtaposition there is so exquisite, Jack. And then your choice of needle drops. What were you looking for musically with Day of the Fight?
It's funny because Sir Ben McDermott is my brother-in-law. It's my sister's husband, and he's a beautiful musician, and they live in Norfolk in England in the countryside. So he's never scored a film, but he has a very, he has a poet, the soul of a poet. And I had an instinct that he would do something quite beautiful. So I sent him the film, and I always had in my head, even with the tennis court, very much a quartet. So a lot of strings, obviously piano at moments, but those strings are very evocative, yeah. I think, of the human soul. Mm-hmm. I think they can soar, and they can also, you know, they can be so intimate, and at the same time, they can be so grand. And it's almost like the spirit, those ups and downs that I really wanted to play with during, you know, I write to music, so every single needle drop was in the move, in the script, and as well as me writing two bits of score, because I know just how important music is. Mm-hmm. Because I find that actually acting is very like music, in essence that you know when you're hitting a false note. It's when you're working with somebody and you're watching a performance, or you're watching two actors or three, whatever it is, together. It's very like listening to music, a bit like, you know, I don't want to say jazz because it's sort of used too liberally, but there is something that you can hear those false notes, you can see those false notes. Everybody, when you're in harmony, I think it's very, very musical, in essence. So, you know, it needed to sort of convey, the music itself needed to convey what Mikey's journey is, and the internal struggle that he's working with and against, in essence. The music was so important in this.
And it really comes through. Ben did an amazing job. And then to punctuate it with the jazz beats with the saxophone player in the subway and your needle drops, which are so beautifully placed as well. And this is also where your sound design comes into play, and how you don't have constant score. It ebbs and flows, just like the music, just like Mikey's Day. But your sound then in that third act, when we have the post-fight buzzing and it gets loud and it gets really loud and then it drops down, that speaks volumes. The way that that is constructed there, and the mix that's done between score, dialogue, and sound. Really beautiful, Jack.
Thank you so much. We had wonderful Lou Goldstein, who was that, and Joe Klotz, our editor, because you just realize how much you play with this stuff in post, and the slightest thing that feels too much or too little, it's such a dance, the entire process, specific in post. And I actually find it so revealing. It's so beautiful because you can find so many moments and almost, you know, emphasize them through score, through sound, through certain bits of design, and how we're pulling things up or pushing, you know, sorry, pushing things up, pulling things back at different moments. So it's very nice for you to mention that. It really does mean a lot.
Bringing up Joe, because the editing goes hand in hand, the visual editing goes hand in hand with that as well. The editing is just exemplary, Jack. And most notably, that third act and those final sequences, as Mikey is, he's back at his apartment, he's walking through, and you have the superimpositions in almost a triptych fashion. Absolutely gorgeous. And I started bawling. I started crying when I saw that.
Oh, I'm so, well, it's meant to do, and that sort of metaphor for the movie. Like,
yeah.
He's living in purgatory. He's living in black and white, you know. It's he's trying to paint color to these memories. And at the very end, what's happening all around him are these projections, quite literal projections of the future. Not necessarily things that have happened, but of wishes that he wishes are going to happen. So they are quite literal in-color projections of the future, because he's gone through that. I always say that sort of elegy of walking through life, the journey, purgatory, to cross the River Styx is in the taxi ride with his father appearing in eclipses. And then that final moment where, when we got his eyes, I said, you know, when you close your eyes, just before you close your eyes, not that we can see it, but I want you to smile. And he smiled, and that's what made the pupil dilate at the last second before he closed his eyes. He smiled.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the completion of that journey, very poetic in essence.
And that's so beautiful, and a lot of people don't realize that you don't have to see somebody smile to know that they're smiling, because when they smile, it changes their eyes, and you can see the smile in their eyes.
Yes, yeah. It's amazing that it works so well. We made the movie in 20 days, so we didn't have much time to do anything. It was so great to have just so many brilliant collaborators. Michael being the absolute anchor in front of the camera. But it is, you know, when you only have a couple of takes because you don't have time to do anything else, God, it's refreshing to be so on the same page with all of those amazing HOD, everybody around you, all working together, understanding the film we were doing. Understanding what the heartbeat of the movie was. That's why those moments work so well, I believe.
That's absolutely, that is so true. Now I'm getting a message. I can only give you one more question. They're going to cut us off.
Oh, okay, go on.
So I have to talk to you about Peter Simonite, your cinematography, and the two of you designing your visual grammar. Absolutely stunning. Your use of slow pans. ECUs are focused on very small things, hands or a piece of paper. The boxing trunks, the silks when he gets them out of the drawer. Otherwise, you keep things a little bit wider in, you know, a mid shot, but a closer mid shot. And your fight sequences that are shot are just stunning, stunning. And I love what you did with the fight choreography with, it's the Rocky Balboa, Apollo Creed, both are on the ground. Is anybody getting up? And of course, the fake out that Ron Perlman pulls off so beautifully with, instead of punching as a southpaw, we go to right or we go from right and then we suddenly become a southpaw. But Peter's lensing and lighting is supreme. Talk to me about how the two of you developed this visual grammar.
Well, I wrote it for it to be in black and white because I always found the films, like from my past, the films that really moved me, that made me want to be a filmmaker. I wanted this to almost have a little homage to those films that we're not seeing much anymore, which are films about feeling, about character. Peter, I found it instantly just like it was simpatico from day one. We totally understood the tone of the film. I wanted to get, I find black and white to be, like I always say, like a magnifying glass to the soul. And I wanted, we used these beautiful 30, you know, the Alexa 35s, but we had these Leica lenses that gave it much more depth than a lot of, which I find quite flat, a lot of the black and white that's done digitally these days. That's almost why we, at one point, were discussing film. But when we did our camera test and we did the black and white with these Leica lenses, it gave us that grit, that grain, and we obviously had the brilliant Tim Stiefen doing the color correction at the end, all added to it. But we only had a day and a half with the fight, so there wasn't really any choreography. I pretty much, you know, Michael had been training for a year, and we were, you know, fighting opposite Cameron. There were certain bits that were full contact, and they were going at it. I just had three cameras. I would say, you can't ask me any questions. I know the beats. We have to hit this, and that's the genius of Joe Klopp, and knowing that I had one of the great, sensitive, brilliant editors, that I knew I could build a brilliant fight in the room, but they just had to go along with the stages because choreography would just slow us down.
Yeah.
And the entire film, to be honest, you know, we were jumping back and forth. A lot of the memories went up to 48 frames rather than the usual 24. Sometimes I'd skip between 32 to 48, but 48, because I always find memories, they don't have a beginning, they don't have an end, but there's a reason why they come to us. Mm-hmm. There is something specific. It could be a smell, it could be a moment, it could be a face, it could be a sound, but they are fleeting, and he's trying to paint these colors, so that's why we use that rather desaturated color in the memories. He's trying to paint this color to his memories. So it's a lot of it sort of plays into the metaphor of what the film wants.
Jack, I don't know how you're ever going to top this film. You have to get behind the camera again. I want to see more from you as a director, a writer-director. Of course, I love seeing you.
I can't wait to do it again. This is the absolute love. I mean, I loved every second of it.
This is your destiny, Jack. I just don't know how you're going to beat this. It is perfection.
That's amazing.
It's perfection.
The highest praise ever. And coming to you, that means so much to me. Honestly, really means a lot.
And I will tell you, I've known Timur, and you worked with Timur. I've known him for so many years. I have never told him a film of his was perfection.
Oh, that's so good. My goodness. I feel like I should just stop the day now and go and that's as good a compliment I've ever gotten. So you mean everything to me right now. It means so much. And we need it because this film is dying, you know, and we're not getting the chance to make films like this. So, you know, we need people to yell it from the rafters.
Well, I will be yelling this one from the rafters for you, Jack. Just absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. It means so much to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope we get to do this again soon.
Oh, I hope so, too. I don't want to wait so long. I mean, you know.
Yeah, we won't wait so long next time. Exactly.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Jack.
Bye, darling. Bye, Annie. Bye.
And that was Jack Huston talking about Day of the Fight. And, you know, to let me bring it a little full circle there with Jack, you heard me mention Timur Bekmambetov, who directed Jack in Ben-Hur. And Timur has been live on the show calling in from Moscow while he was editing Ben-Hur. And one of the more memorable call-in guests, as it was 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night in Moscow, and heard clinking, and yes, he was drinking vodka. One of the more fun moments out of many over the past 10 years here on Behind the Lens. But if you haven't seen Day of the Fight yet, it's in theaters. I encourage you to see it. It is a beautiful, beautiful film. Now, I know John is on hold, but before I bring him live, I just have to mention a huge shout-out to writer-director James North for this incredibly cool swag box that was delivered to my door the other day for his new film, Filthy Animals, which you're going to find out all about on my website, but it's a lot of fun. Another first-time feature filmmaker. And it's got a ton of stuff happening. It's bloody. It's fun. And very cool swag. So, John and crew, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for that. And I've already got pictures up on social media of today's tablescape. So you can see the shirt, the hat, a bloody nutcracker, all kinds of cool stuff was in my swag box from them. So thank you to the whole Filthy Animals team. And one more mention. I saw these. I didn't know how they'd turn out. But go online to scorchedlaserworks.com. If you want some really cool gifts for the filmmakers in your life, people in the film industry, they do, Nick and Amanda do the most incredible work. Be it on wood, be it on acrylic, doing laser cutouts. They customize, personalize everything. And clapboards, director's chairs, all these really cool things. Ornaments for your tree, ornaments for your keychain. Just really incredible, incredible work. And I liked what I bought so much, I had to order a couple more things as gifts for some people. So check them out, scorchlaserworks.com. Really neat stuff. And the prices are not bad either. And, you know, that's always important in this day and age. All right, so now I'm going to bring him live. I don't know if I'm ready for this. Welcome, John Corcoran.
Hey, Debbie, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me. I heard you guys you're talking about vodka in Russia. Sounds like a blast.
Well, I don't know if I ever told you this or if you ever heard this episode of the show, but I think in like the second year of the show, maybe, Timur Bekmambetov was a guest. Timur was a guest. He's done the show 3 times. And he was editing Ben-Hur, and he called in live from Russia, from his home. It was like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and I could hear clinking. And you know that I know what ice cubes sound like clinking. And I'm like, Timur, what is that I hear? Oh, ice. It's night. Drinking some vodka. So what better thing for my show, John? A guest.
You know, sometimes in those late edit sessions, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
But yeah, he was editing Ben-Hur. And I brought it up only because Jack and I had just talked about Timur in my interview that I had with Jack Houston, because he was in Ben-Hur. So I just thought that was a great, you know, 10-year tidbit to toss in here. But wow, I'm so happy to have you on the show. I mean, it's like I'm going through all of you, you know, Charlie, who's one of your producers and who also is the voice of the Radiocaster in Sky Forest. Charlie has been here in studio twice, once talking about his coloring book, his Giggle Stick coloring book, another time talking about his limerick book. Jordan, of course, as I said at the top of the show, Jordan used to shoot the show when we were filming it every week until Big Boss Nick put in this stupid Mevo thing, whatever that is. I still don't know what it is, and I don't like it. And then he shot carpets for me. Ruby even worked on Sky Forest.
Yeah, that's right.
But she hasn't been on the show yet. But Jordan's been on the show, part of the show. Charlie's been on the show. And you remember Andrew?
Of course.
Yeah, Andrew wrote the theme song for the show.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
Andrew wrote the theme song, and then Frank retooled it last year and made it, you know, instead of being more Max Steiner or Bernard Herrmann, he retooled it with a kind of jazzy vibe to it. So, yeah, I have the people I like.
Yeah, well, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. It's a total honor, and to be not only among those people who I love very much, but also among all the other amazing guests you've had over the years. It's a great honor. So I really appreciate you having me here.
I mean, I was doing counting the other day, and I didn't realize I've had over 700 live guests on the show in 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It just blows my mind. And then over 750 pre-recorded exclusive interviews. And you're going to close out year 10 talking about...
I hope I can live up to the hype.
Oh, I think...
Big shoes.
I think you can. You're more than capable. You survived Snowpiercer, for goodness sakes.
I did.
So The frozen tundra. And you came out on the other side of that.
I did. Better man, too.
Obviously. But our main focus is going to be your film, Sky Forest. I watched it again. So this is now 4 times I've watched this film, John. I watched it again at 2 o'clock this morning. And I just love it. I love this film. What you have done, number one, and right now, especially since you just played the Culver City Film Festival in downtown at the Regal, or whatever they're calling it now, you know, in view of the Malibu fires, Sky Forest is set at the time of the Crestline fires. So it's very timely to see and talk about this film now. But because it is sci-fi, it is a thriller, I can't believe how well you established tension and anticipation. You and Jordan, because Jordan also cut this with you. That, in 15 minutes time, John, you had me on the edge of my seat. And when it ended, I'm like, where's more? I want more. I want more.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, you know, and a little bit about the fire issues is as we were in the post for this process, a giant fire over in the San Bernardino Mountain, the Line Fire, actually encroached on the location where we shot and got within about 100 feet.
Oh my God.
Of burning down that location. So the fire, while we used it, you know, as a catalyst for this whole story, and there is a very real threat going on up there. And luckily, the firefighters up there did an amazing job and were able to save, you know, the entire town of Running Springs, which is where we shot, except for I think one house, unfortunately, was lost to the fire. But, you know, it is kind of just made it feel a little bit realer, you know, and like you said, with the Miami stuff, too. So it is we really wanted that. We wanted a sci-fi film set in this world, in our reality. And I'm very happy that we were able to kind of bring that all together.
So when did you first get the idea for Sky Forest?
It was probably a year and a half ago to 2 years ago, maybe even. I wanted to do something in the sci-fi space that could just be at its core about fundamental human emotions. You know, I see Sky Forest as a simple film about secrets and the damage they can cause to relationships, you know, and I basically wanted to set up these three characters where they all are keeping things from each other, you know, and I wanted that to be eating beneath the surface the entire film. And, you know, and a huge part of that,
Uh-oh, we lost you there, John. Uh-oh. We lost John.
I'm sorry about that.
What did you do? Where are you?
Sorry about that, Debbie. A little technical difficulty here.
Can
you hear me now?
And yes, I can hear you now. We can do a Verizon commercial. and what were you doing? What were you talking
about? No, my headphones just crapped out for a second there. I don't know what happened, so I just got rid of them. Now I'm just talking, you know, the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, funny. What do I always lecture about? How many times have you heard me lecture about no Zoom, no headphones, using real phones? How many times have you heard this lecture?
Well, I just wanted to keep you on your toes, I guess.
Oh, God. I'm too old.
Too old. Sorry about that, but... No, as I was saying, I mean, a huge part of that, the tension, was certainly my partner in crime on this, which is Jordan Johnson. You know, he was the DP, the editor, and the producer. And he just got it from the very beginning, from our first, you know, kind of conception of how we were going to do this and how we could do this. And we wanted to infuse into every shot that we chose the idea that people are hiding things. You know, we wanted to... you know, obstruct our characters in a way where they feel, where everybody is hiding things until kind of the end, where we start opening it up a little bit. That was very much an intentional choice. So it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this project. It's been a massive, massive learning experience so far. And it continues. You know, as you said, we just had our West Coast premiere at the Culver City Film Festival, which went really well. We had a packed theater. A ton of people came out to support, and I think it went over really well. You know, It's been a real blast, and it's continuing, you know, to today and through today, and I get to talk to you about it. So it's just kind of the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, and it should. And I mean, this is a beautiful proof of concept calling card for you. I've got to tell you, Jordan, this really is, it speaks volumes as to your vision as a director. Jordan, I cannot believe the growth in Jordan. I'm putting that out there. Jordan's work with the camera, to see his growth in his shots, the deliberateness, the focus, honing in, I am beyond impressed. And that's always a big thing with me, is I like to see the growth in filmmakers, in artisans, and I definitely see it in Jordan. So you guys really, that collaboration works so well for the two of you.
Yeah, Jordan is he is a true shutterbug. You know, he loves it. He loves cameras. He has, you know, a room in his house that is just filled to the brim with camera equipment. He has so much. He's constantly, every time I talk to him, he's on some new gig. He's out there doing it. He is just a total hustler. And to get to work with him on this from a producerial standpoint was just an absolute blast. And, you know, there are a lot of people who did a lot to make this movie happen. But I'd say the two people who spent the most time with it are me and Jordan. Mm-hmm. So it was very much, it really felt like our baby.
You know, how did you come up with the visual grammar for Sky Forest because of the deliberateness in the shots? Now, number one, your location plays a huge part. That house with the low ceilings, it just plays right into the idea of secrets and being hidden and something's covered up. So your location is ideal. But then your shots are very composed. They're very deliberate. And then going into the editing process, your hold time and what you're showing us, what you're not showing us, you're playing with the Hitchcockian ideas. So
yes,
talk to
absolutely.
Me about designing this visual grammar with Jordan that really sets a tone.
From the very beginning, what we wanted to do was an isolated thing, a thing that we could be done with just a few actors in an isolated space. So from the very beginning, isolation and the idea of, you know, being trapped or you know, being unknowingly trapped was constantly something we were talking about. And in regards to, you know, the actual visual grammar, we did, three separate location scouts up at that location where we would actually go through, and instead of storyboarding, we would just take photos, still photos of ourselves as the characters, putting them, in exactly how we wanted them. And then on the actual day that we shot, I had a big book of those photos, of those goofy photos where I'm like, you know, wearing a towel around my head so that people know that I'm the Melissa Drew character, the Michelle character and the stuff. But it's funny. But when you actually look at what ended up on screen, it is like exactly those photos. So it was a very fun and time-intensive process, but it was a very enlightening process because we literally got to walk through our sets and go through every way we want to shoot them beforehand, you know. And the shot list was a we wanted to do even more, you know, as most shot lists, you know, I'm sure go through that process, but we did several big cuts to what we actually wanted to do and, you know, had to kind of come to Jesus a little bit with, what we had planned and what we did. So we kind of had to, it was kind of in constant motion, but we wanted to keep that idea of not that these people are hiding things. You know, mm-hmm. when you see them, we don't want you to just see them. We want to see them slightly blocked by someone else's shoulder or slightly blocked through a window pane, or we want to be watching them from afar or through a car window. That was very much our intention, and I'm honestly, I'm very proud of it. I feel like that, to me, when I watch it, it feels like, because we had that vision and because we went on that journey, it feels elevated. And I think people are picking up on that, even if they're not necessarily understanding that our intention behind it. I think they just pick up on it from a, you know, from a visual sense.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like it looks, it looks crafted, you know, and,
yeah.
And that's a huge, huge props to Jordan and our crew. You know, we had a really amazing crew, very, you know, small crew, but very hardworking, tight knit crew. So it was a, it was an absolute blast, you know, and, yeah.
Well, one of the great things when the film opens and we get the great aerial shots. Now, did Jordan shoot those with drones?
That was actually done by Brian Binns, who's another backstage guy, who's a very talented camera operator himself. He actually ended up being our, you know, our second camera unit and, mm-hmm. and running the, he has a, you know, a nice drone and ran those shots for us. You know, and that was a lot of fun. And you'll like this too. The person driving all those shots is of course Charlie.
Of course it was Charlie.
Yeah,
you know,
he's our precision driver.
But what I love, because we open and we've got those aerial shots of a lone car driving on a twisting road. Now, I have joked with Dion Taylor for years about this with so many of his films, because that's how he opens quite a few of them, with twisty roads going through mountains and things like that. And that really sets a tone. It's very metaphoric for the twists and turns that are about to unfold. Or, you know, warning, sharp curve ahead. And that really plays into a film like this, with Dion, like so many of his darker films. And I love that this is how you open it. We have a radio announcer talking about a fire, the Crestline fire, and they believe it was caused by a weather balloon. Really great nod to the hubbub a couple years ago about the Chinese weather balloons that were over the United States.
Exactly.
So you're pulling from pop culture and actual news and incorporating that. So you're already setting the stage. And then we get to our location. Our first, we go to the house. Nobody's answering the door, but then we get in the house. And there's water running, full steam, with full steam. A tea kettle is, it's whistling and whistling and whistling. There's chopped vegetables, but there's nobody there. So you set this stage for tension and uncertainty immediately, from the aerials to our first introduction into this house. And that really, it puts you in the mindset of, oh my God, what is going on? And then it takes off from there. You have structured this so well, John, so well. And that's one of the things that really impresses me about this, is the metaphor and your visual structure, your visual tonal bandwidth that really picks up on the emotional tonal bandwidth and the story, the beats.
I really appreciate that, you know, and in regards to that opening shot, you know, it's obviously a trope, you know, the
sure.
driving cars, but it's a great trope. So we wanted to use it and be unashamed, you know, like unabashedly use it. And I think it turned out really well. You know, I actually had some people read the script and say, you know, you might not need it. You might be able to spend more time just in the cabin. And I was pretty diehard about, no, I think we absolutely
yeah.
need it. This is a film called Sky Forest.
Yeah.
We need to see the mountains. We need to see this shot. We need to feel above it. We need to feel like we are elevated above this story and then come down into it and be intimate with it. And that was a very important step. You know, the big one for us is obviously the beginning of The Shining. You know, that was
yeah.
one I looked at many times. But, it, you know, Evil Dead also does the same thing. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
it is certainly a thing, and it was one that I really am glad we did. And in doing so, I've heard a lot of compliments about. You know, I think it elevates the film as a whole to be able to be up there in the sky watching the story and kind of getting the, you know, the blue sky version of this world before we go down into the nitty gritty and we get the interpersonal conflicts that come inside
yeah.
the cabin.
No, you very smartly, that was a very smart move. I'm glad you stuck to your guns. And you have that there because it does add so much. But as I said, it helps build that mindset for the audience of the twists and turns. And maybe not consciously, but subconsciously, your mind sees something like that. And, you know, Danger Will Robinson.
Exactly.
You know, we're getting told. But now, feeding into all of this, we get into, and we're not going to give away any spoilers, but with forest, sky, fires, there's flames, there's red, there is super, super, super color. Now, we've had wonderful mountainous colors with greens and an idyllic house with, you know, essentially a quote-unquote a picket fence around it. And the vibrancy of the vegetables that are being cut, the peppers that are being cut, red, yellow. Ooh, red, yellow. Colors in fire. so you dug deep in here, John. But
yeah,
we get into the big secret. There's a huge secret that Kenny is keeping. And that really just catapults everything when he takes Alex out to say, hey, want to see what I got in the shed? And it's done at night, so you get some beautiful, your colorist did an amazing job, you get beautiful color with red against the inky blue black of night, against the dark green of the trees that are right there. But also then you bring in your sound design and the sounds of night with the crickets, the kikitas. You hear that hum of the bug, you know, the bug life, the insect life at night. But then you introduce another sound. So you think at first it might be heightened bugs, but it ain't. All of this, when we get outside, it is so well-crafted with minutiae, John. Walk me through how you designed this and what you did to achieve that.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned some of these people so I can mention them and throw praise their way because, first off, our colorist, Miles Kula, he works out of Company 3, was instrumental in making this film feel the way we wanted. You know, we shot with these Soviet era lenses that essentially give a softer image to everything. We made that conscious decision because we wanted it to feel different. You know, there's so many films nowadays that are shot on these beautiful, amazing cameras and these really intense, crisp pictures. We made a conscious decision to go away from that and to kind of make you feel almost a fantasy realm. You know, even though it's not a fantasy film, we almost wanted it to feel a little different. And that was something that went through through the whole color process. And Miles did such an amazing job with juxtaposing those dark blues and the blacks with the red and bringing out little pieces of red here and there. That was another thing we talked about. If you'll notice throughout the film, there's there's a red lawn chairs at one point. There's the red on the keys. We're trying to send this message early, you know, that while the danger isn't here, the danger is here. You know, right. While you don't see it, it is under there, under the surface. So he was just instrumental and so helpful and so just really great. You know, a talented young colorist who I'm sure is going to have an excellent career. And then our sound design. You know, when it comes to sound design, along with our composer Luisa, who we can talk about later, are to me the real heroes of Sky Forest. Our mixers, our re-recording mixers and sound supervisors. We had two of them. One named Christina Wen. She works out of Signature Post, and then Bob Merkel, who also works out of Signature Post. Mm-hmm. Christina, you know, had worked with my wife Tina, who's also a producer on the film. You know, Tina is a veteran producer and post producer in town, and she knows a lot of people and she has a lot of connections, and she had worked with Christina before. And so Christina came on and she immediately just threw herself full bore in, you know, because she knew what this was, and it was an opportunity to let the sound and let the sound design do the talking and mm-hmm. tell the story. We knew from the beginning we weren't going to show a lot. We were going to let the sounds and the image and kind of the tone do a lot of the tension for this film. And I think honestly, I cannot be happier than how it turned out. I think they were so incredible and so professional, and they just had such a great attitude. And the way that Christina and Bob did things was honestly so fun to watch. And basically we sat down with them in the early stages when we had our final cut or our final cut before we went into post, mm-hmm. and we kind of just sat down and we went through and we said, you know, here's what we want here. Here's what we'd like here. You know, we talked about this idea of, you know, there's a card game in there when they're playing cards, like this should be a fun game where they're having fun, but there also is this underlying tension and we want to feel that. And we want to, you know, juxtapose what should be a warm scene with the darkness of kind of what is going on between them and what's kind of lurking outside the house in the tool shed, you know.
That poker game, that card game, you could have cut the tension with a knife. That was, but, you know, with the sound, what I also love, and this is where Luis's work comes into play with the score, and, you know, in those last 5 minutes, 7 minutes, then we start hearing percussive tom-toms and some strings. And it's really interesting. And it gets as the sound, the night sounds of insects and all, those pleasant sounds that will put you to sleep, they start fading out and these other sounds come up, the musical sounds. And it's really interesting and it's very intense and it really slams home the fear and tension at that moment. And then we get a really killer shot. I'm not going to say what it is, but you've got to see this short. It's just, and you know which one I'm talking about.
Yes.
Yes. Jordan did such an amazing job with that. And then the visual effects people came in.
Yep.
Just every little thing, John, you paid attention to.
You know, it really helps to have a wife who is a blunt truth teller and does not pull punches and is going, and from the very beginning, it's like if she was going to be on my project, our project was going to have to be good, mm-hmm. which is obviously what everybody wants. But you know, for somebody like Tina, who's been around so much high quality stuff, it has to be that good. And I think I'm so grateful that she took on this project with me and brought in all these people she knew to really help us strengthen every single facet. And you know, being married to somebody from the post-production side, I know how important it is. You know, there's this tendency to ignore post or we'll fix it in post. This whole idea, it's like, yes, you can fix things in post, but really what you should be trying to do is make post life as easy as possible, because they are going to, no matter where you end, they are going to make your film so much better.
Right.
And that was the case here. And you know, I wanted to talk about Luisa for a second, because Luisa, and I told her this after the film, and maybe I'm not qualified to make this call, but I told her, I said, I think that someday you're going to win an Oscar, and I'm going to be very happy that that I got to work with you way back when, because she is, honestly, you know, I think she's a prodigy. She's an incredible violinist, an incredible composer. She works out of remote control, you know, Hans Zimmer's place, and she's she assists a bigwig composer. But honestly, she's so talented. I imagine it won't be long before she is the bigwig composer herself. And I think she was just, her attitude and her enthusiasm and her, she had that same similar take that Christina and Bob did, where she saw this and she said, ooh, this is something where the music is a character, mm-hmm. where the things I can do is essentially create this character, make it feel big, make it feel scary. Yeah. And the strings and the things she can do with the strings. And she used a metal viol, an electric violin for our final credits song, you know, which was a great, I think I could tell she had a lot of fun with. So it was, you know, working with her was just really, really awesome, you know, and then the VFX that you're talking about, we didn't have a ton of VFX, but we did have a couple VFX shots, and they were done by Tower 33. And they really knocked out of the park, especially on that shot you're talking about, you know, and just watching that shot the other day at the West Coast premiere, you know, on the big screen and seeing people's reaction, you know, we show the shot and then we cut away really hard to something else.
Uh-huh.
And I could feel it, you know, I could feel it in the room that it worked. And for me, that was like such a satisfying moment to know that this plan that we had to show just enough to keep people a little uneasy. I think it had worked, and that was very awesome. And I've had people since then come up to me and tell me how awesome that shot was. So a huge props to Jordan and to the people over at Tower 33 for their awesome work. But yeah, you know, this was such a massive learning experience for me personally. But the one thing that I learned over and over again, and, you know, I think it goes without saying, but until you go through it, it means more once you do go through it, mm-hmm. is that it is just such a massive team effort.
Yeah.
You know, I helped shepherd it. You know, I wrote it and I directed it and I helped keep everybody together and I helped keep the vision, you know, centered in the place we wanted. But literally there are so many people who it just would not be possible without. And I think that's a really enlightening and kind of a freeing experience to some degree. You know, I'm sure there's many auteur directors out there who are very very specific and particular about exactly what they want. And I was specific and particular about the vision, but if somebody had a good idea,
how to get there,
let's go with the good idea,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think from top to bottom, that was so much fun for me. And it just kind of showed that, you know, I've been predominantly a screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, my time. And you know, with the strikes and with COVID, I've just had this urge to kind of connect back with that childhood urge that I had to make movies. And I'm going to be honest, while we were up there shooting this film, I felt like, you know, 14-year-old John shooting out in the field behind his house. You know, I felt that back. And that's maybe the thing that I've been chasing my entire time out here. So it's pretty amazing to do it and to live it and to do it with some of my best friends in the world, to mm-hmm. do it with my wife, to do it with, you know, Charlie, who's been just like the one of the great creative people in my life for, you know, over 10 years
yeah.
now, to do it with Jordan, who's also been just one of my great friends in Los Angeles. It was a very fun experience, and it continues to be fun, which is really awesome. You know, it's been, and you know, it's just, and now I get to talk about it with you, which is even more fun. So it's just, filmmaking can be fun. Sometimes you have to, remind yourself that in a town that can be, you know, a little brutal, but when you do it like this with people that you love and a story that you really want to tell and that you want to have fun with, it can be just a great experience. And this one certainly was.
Well, I know something my dad always said, and I mean, the man spent 60 years in television broadcasting at the same place. And he always said, people would ask him, Ed, don't you want to change? Don't you want to do this? And don't you want to do that? And it's like, no, I love what I do. I love the people I work with. And, you know, he always said, that's the key. You've got to work at what you love and with the people you love being with. And I think that's so important, and never more so than in film and television, because of the very nature of the beast. And you've surrounded yourself with great people, and they've all surrounded themselves with you. So that's a win-win as far as I'm concerned. And then you all have me to champion all of you. So, I mean, what more could you want?
It's all wins.
You know, I've got to ask you about Louisa. With all the mm-hmm. string, did she actually play the violin for that? Because that tremolo with the percussion, the tom-tom kind of beat in those last few minutes, incredible. And I'm curious, because she's a violinist, did she play the violin, the strings herself?
Oh, she did. Okay. She is an incredible violinist. You know, you can hear some of her stuff online. Louisa Byron is her name, and she is just so good at what she does. But she's so good at just, you know, playing music. But that's almost mm-hmm. like a separate skill set to how yeah. good she is at being a composer. She played most of the instruments throughout. She had her husband, Ben Knorr, also. He played some guitar for us on some tracks, or, you know, on a couple tracks. And then also she had somebody she works with, I believe, also play a little bit of something, you know, when she needed some help. But for the most part, every instrument in there is Louisa.
Wow.
You know, basically the maestro herself, you know, stringing wow. it all together. And I love that you brought up that final sequence. You know, when we did the temp version, we said, all right, from here on out, it can only build, mm-hmm. you know, there is no more lulls at this point, you know, and we picked, yeah. we knew it was like basically, you know, the final two scenes, we were like, from this moment on, we need to figure out a way to build this story continuously, to end with a bang, and to keep people wanting more at the end there. And we had this idea of a heartbeat. You know,
yeah.
And basically just like you're listening to this dum-dum, dum-dum mm-hmm. over and over again. And Louisa kind of took that and ran with it. And I could not be happy. It's like you know, sometimes you get really attached to a temp score yeah. or a temp piece of music. And you're like, oh, man, how am I going to ever hear anything but that? As soon as I heard anything that Louisa did, the temp stuff was gone. It was like, oh, never mind. We've got something better, which is just so amazing and such a fun experience to have somebody just elevate everything you need, you ask of them, they just elevated it. They elevated it even more, you know, and by the end, I was just like, everything she's doing, I can give her little, you know, maybe I'll give her a little tweak, but for the most part, I mean, she's just knocking it out of the park,
yeah.
you know, and it was just so much fun.
But I mean, I just love how the sound, you know, the sound effects, the night sounds, how they slowly morphed into the tremolo, the percussive tom-toms, almost like a tribal drumming.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because I thought of that while I was watching the series finale of Yellowstone last night.
Oh, nice.
How the tom-tom beat in the end of Yellowstone, where they now have the Yellowstone back, the Native Americans have it back, the reservation has it back, and they're cleansing, and all the tom-toms. And that's one reason that I rewatched Sky Forest last night at 2 o'clock in the morning. Was those drums reminded me of what I heard in those last 5 to 7 minutes of Sky Forest. So
absolutely.
That's, you know.
Well, that's huge praise, too.
I'll tell you, yeah. You know, we go from Brian Tyler's work to Louisa's work. What can I say?
Yeah. Yep.
Now, through all of this, mister, what amazes me is you started this journey a year and a half ago. You made it through COVID, through all the strikes. You get this done. But along the way, and before that, you had your baseball movie that mm-hmm. kind of fell flat because of the strikes. And then you picked up this little gig in the writer's room of Snowpiercer. You have continually, and you ended up co-writing episode 8 in the final season. You have continually, over all these years, John, you keep moving forward. And you keep dipping your toe in. And you dip your toe in. And then you dip your foot in. And then you dip your leg in. And you just keep going. Until you get to full body immersion with Sky Forest. I'm curious how all of these steps along the way, such as your screenplay that I still want to see made one day, your baseball screenplay,
mm-hmm.
You know, how all of them, how you navigated each one and built upon the last to get to where you are now.
You know, it has been a journey. You know, I first moved out to Los Angeles right after I graduated college in 2011. You know, when you first come out to town, and especially when you're like me and you have zero connections, you really, you're kind of just thrown into the deep end. You don't know what you're going to do. All I knew is I wanted to write. So, so I'm going to start writing. I get an internship at Lawrence Bender Productions. You know, I'm running around town picking up vegan dog food and bottles of Cristal and bringing them to parties and stuff. And just kind of, you know, I'm reading coverage and I'm doing all that. But that's an unpaid internship. And then eventually I have to get a job. You know, I get a job at a rental car company that takes up a lot of my time that I absolutely hated. And then I get a job at Backstage Bar, you know, which has really been a huge, huge part of my life for the last 13 years because it's kept me alive and it's kept me creative and it's given me my days to pursue the things I want to pursue and to, you know, be the creative that I want to be. And I've done a lot of different things, you know, and for a long time as a screenwriter, I had a writing partner and we had, you know, some very, very close calls with, you know, the quote unquote big break. You know, we had our film, the baseball film, you know, which was based off of the book Teammate, which is the biography of David Ross, who was the backup catcher of the Chicago Cubs in 2016. And it was the story about how this 40-year-old catcher, you know, took a bunch of young superstar baseball players under his wing and taught them the ways of how to be a professional and ended up breaking the 108-year curse for the Chicago Cubs. And honestly, I cannot stress this enough. It was my absolute, hands down, dream project.
I know.
You know, you get this ability to. I'm a diehard Cubs fan. I'm from Chicago. It was a dream come true. I got to write it. I got to meet David Ross. I had him come into Backstage. I got to, you know, go on all these meetings all over town and pitch it. I got the whole full water bottle tour.
Yep.
But in an industry where things, you just never know, the movie ends up, you know, falling to the wayside, you know, and they're still out there trying to make it. But, you know, what form it takes, I don't actually know if it takes or whatever. You know, I hope it does, but whatever it ends up taking, it's not necessarily the one that I wrote back in the day at this point. But that's part of the process. You know, you learn this stuff about town. So I had this first massive thing where I'm like, I made it. And then it goes away. You know, not a sad story, but a story that teaches you about yourself and teaches you how to learn and how to keep going. The next big thing I had is with that same writing partner, we packaged and sold a based on true story anthology miniseries about female whistleblowers to ABC. So I went through this whole massive thing where we got the rights to three different female whistleblowers. We ended up crossing the finish line. We packaged together with Chelsea Handler Productions and with Lincoln Square Productions. And we end up doing the whole big Hollywood pitch. And there's 20 people in the room and we knock it out of the park. We sell the pitch. It's one of the coolest experiences ever. Walking out of the elevator, you know, people are congratulating us. And I'm like, I did it again. I made it, you know, I'm in. But then tragically, you know, the process of negotiating contracts, that takes a long time. It took about, you know, a year in our case. Then we're starting to make it and we're in the process of it. And our showrunner, a wonderful woman, you know, they paired us up with a veteran showrunner and a wonderful woman by the name of Bettina Jilawa. You know, she wrote the Bessie Smith story and she wrote McFarlane USA. She's a very talented woman. She tragically passed away. So, and which was obviously horrible. You know, for her and for her family, and just a heartbreaking thing, because she's really taken me under her wing and kind of taught me how to be a professional writer. So that hit like a ton of bricks. And then the show, as things happen, goes into turnaround. You know, they're not interested anymore, just kind of floats around and all of a sudden it's gone. So now I've had two like brushes with that quote unquote big break. And this one hurt maybe even more. I'm like, wow, I thought we had it. I mean, we sold it. The money was coming in. We had done it. We made it, you know, and again, it's gone. So, you know, then me and my writing partner, we split up after a long time. And, you know, I love the guy, but it was time. It was time for me to start getting good at all the things that I wanted to get good at. You know, sometimes in your writing partnership, you have a tendency to find your roles and get good at those roles. Where I'm like, if I'm going to be dependent on myself, I need to be fully dependent on myself. So we split up, and I ended up going my separate ways. And then, you know, and that's right in the middle of COVID. So now the business is shut down. You know, I have zero prospects. What's going to happen? Who knows? Then I luckily, through a contact, I'm able to become a writer's assistant on season 4 of Snowpiercer, which to me was kind of a renaissance for me, I think, in a lot of ways. I got to work with a bunch of professional writers in the room and see how a television show is supposed to be made, you know, and it was a fun show. It was right up my alley. I love sci-fi thrillers. It was literally everything that I kind of wanted. And it was eye-opening for me. And for more ways than one, because it was a huge learning experience, but I also kind of realized, oh, I can do this. You know, I can do this. I have the skills. I have the you know, mentality. I have the ability to work with people. Like, I can do this. So it was a huge eye-opener. And then, you know, thankfully, because the executive producers, they gave me a shot. And I got to co-write, you know, episode 8 of season 4.
Yep.
Which honestly was a dream come true. They flew me up to Vancouver. I got to be on set. I got to work hand in hand with actors. I got to go into people's dressing rooms, you know, and pitch them lines. I got to, and, you know, I think there's a tendency for veteran writers, and I completely understand this, but veteran writers who know the television industry to be a little annoyed by things like that. Because, you know, there's a tendency of just, you know, why don't you write it? Why don't you just read what I wrote? But for me, coming at this place where I'm like just so happy to be there, it was a thrill. Like, every second of it was a thrill. And like, some of it was very hard, some of it was very brutal, but it was a thrill from top to bottom. And I'm so thankful for it. And to finally see, after all this time, after 13 years, finally see my episode come out on AMC, which is, you know, no slouch of a network. It's been a really great year, basically, is what I'm saying. You know, but it's my journey is not without its ups and downs, as everyone's journey is. But I would say that I feel like I'm at the best place that I've ever been creatively, which is a great feeling. You know, after this long, it's kind of, I'm getting to the point where I've already done a lot. You know, I always use this metaphor. Like, if I were to die tomorrow, you could put screenwriter and filmmaker on my tombstone and it wouldn't be a lie. You know, I've already done it. The rest is gravy on top, you know. And I think that mentality is maybe freeing me up a little bit for doing things the way I want to do them, you know, which is a huge thing that I've kind of started to grapple with the older I get. This idea that, you know, should you write something that people want you to write, or should you write the thing that you want to write, you know, and obviously, marketability plays a role in every project. But I think the older I get, the more I say, if I really love something, if I really put everything that I have into it, and I write that, and I write it that way, the people who read it, they know. They feel that love. They feel that how much I care about it, and they feel that passion. And it's almost like, write the, you know, that's kind of one of the things that I've started to tell people when they ask me, you know, younger writers, when they ask me, I say, write the thing you love, you know, don't worry too much about, you know, you have to worry a little bit, obviously, about the business, but write what is going to make you passionate, what's going to make you sit down at that computer every day and write something that means something to you. That's the kind of thing that I myself am grappling with. And you know what? It seems to be working. So, you know, I got a long way to go, but I'm feeling good about it.
So now, with Sky Forest on the festival circuit, where do you go from here? More festivals? Are you selling yourself to get on staff for another writing job? Where are you going, John, other than the backstage? Because God knows I have to have you there to make my drink the way I like it.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, I have my priorities.
No, I'd say in regards to Sky Forest, Sky Forest from the very beginning was a proof of concept. So we wanted something that could stand alone as a short and do well on the festival circuit, mm-hmm. and something that will serve as part of the pitch for the feature version. So I have been writing a very detailed outline of the feature version, and I'll probably end up writing the script. But it's a very detailed, basically shot by shot, scene by scene, of what the feature is going to look like. And it's a similar story, but on a bigger scale, same amount of, you know, maybe one new character, but it's an isolated story, but it's the bigger version. It's the version, that crosses from that sci-fi thriller into a kind of sci-fi thriller horror space. You know, I've been kind of saying it is The Thing meets Evil Dead. But that will be, you know, priority one in the new year. Like, let's go out and let's, you know, whether we sell the script, whether we raise the money to make it ourselves, you know, whatever. I think we're pretty open to how we want to do it, but it's going to be now is going to be building that pitch and using the short itself as one of our main pitch tools. So that's certainly going to be a big part of hitting the ground running in 2025. And I don't know if you've heard the term that I've been hearing all year long, and it's stay alive till 25. So, you know, that's kind of what I'm guessing everybody in town is also planning on doing. So it's going to be, you know, with the hope that business is going to pick up in town in 2025.
It
and
needs
hopefully
to.
It will. I think everybody's just kind of holding their breath right now. But that's certainly, that's number one. The next thing I'm going to be doing is trying to get on other television shows. You know, I think I really, really enjoyed my time in Snowpiercer. And there was something about it that told me that this is where I should be. I should be in a writer's room. I should be spitballing ideas with a group of creative people. Like, I think, you know, there's something so freeing to being around a bunch of writers mm-hmm. trying to crack a story. You know, there's something so freeing about being, about, you know, pitching ideas, even if the idea isn't that great, because it leads you to what the next idea mm-hmm. is, which could be the great one. You know, it's like everything is part of the bigger thing. And that was a lot of fun for me. It really was. And so I think I'm going to be chasing, try and look to get into another writer's room, you know, forever. So that'll be certainly on the docket in the new year.
Well, I mean, I think that is a fantastic plan. I think it's a fantastic plan, so that you're not pigeonholing yourself and you've got multiple things going. And, you know, is there, number one, do you have any more festivals coming up for Sky Forest?
We just got into the Miami International Sci-Fi Festival, which is going to be premiering on January 19th in Miami. So if anybody out there listening is going to be around the Miami area, you can find tickets to the festival at the Miami International Sci-Fi Festival. So we're very excited about that. We do have a few more festivals that we submitted to that we could get into over the next, you know, the next couple months. But after that, you know, we will be, that's probably going to be the end of the festival run, and it's going to be all about pushing the feature version.
Now, what about selling, like, you know, there was HD Shorts for a while, and they bought, you know, a short, well, an episodic that I produced, Bunker. But there are some places that are buying shorts as fillers, as blocks for programming. Any chance of?
You know, I'd certainly be interested in hearing something like that out. You know, I think the big goal, you know, I think is a feature
it's
version.
A feature.
But that doesn't mean I wouldn't listen if somebody was interested, I wouldn't take the meeting, or I wouldn't not take the meeting. You know, so, and again, that would also have to do with my other producers too. You know, Tina and Jordan and Charlie, they would all, you know, have a say in that matter too. So how we do it, I think I don't want to necessarily say we have to do it one way. I just know that Sky Forest was meant to be part of a bigger version, and that bigger version is still calling to me, you know, and we've been with it now for, you know, a year and a half. I still feel it. I still feel like there's a world for it. I still think people could really enjoy it. I think it could be done for a relatively lower budget,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's the way I'm writing it. That's the way I plan it. And, you know, and hopefully we can make that happen.
Well, I want to see a feature. I want to know what this thing is. What are we dealing with? What is that weather balloon really hiding? What was that lame excuse from the government of a weather balloon? What is really happening in the San Bernardino Mountains?
Yep.
I want to know what is in that shed.
Well, hopefully we can make it happen. We can enlighten everyone a little bit.
No, you don't realize how much I really want to know. Because I just, it's like, it ends, and I'm like, no! No, you really...
Yeah, you know what?
You achieved...
The cliffhanger was a very big part of the, you know, it was something that was very, we did it on purpose. We wanted wanting more. And we've heard it from a lot of people. I want more. Now, hopefully that will translate to when we're out there trying to pitch the big version.
Now, with the festivals you've been in already, have you heard from any distributors, executives, anything like that?
Not yet, no. Not from distributors. You know, we've heard a lot of positive feedback from people seeing it, though. You know, certainly, especially a ton from this recent preview or this recent screening at the Culver City Film Festival. We've heard a ton. We've had people from other films reaching out to us. You know, we've had festivals call and tell us how much they liked it. You know, but in regards to distributors, not yet.
Yeah. I'm also interested in the executives reaching out, saying, hey, you got a good product here.
Absolutely.
You know, you want to develop it further. But, John, job just so, so well done on Sky Forest by all of you, even Charlie. No. Just kidding. No, job so well done on Sky Forest. Everybody in Miami, they should. For the Miami International Film Fest, they should definitely get whatever block, whatever shorts block it's going to be screening in. Get your tickets and see it. But now, are you going to create a website for this?
You know, we're just kind of relying right now on social media. We're going to be just posting a ton on social media, on Facebook and on Instagram. The festival, the day of the festival or the block for the Miami Sci-Fi International is going to be it's the Sunday afternoon block. It's the 19th. I forget which day that actually is, but it's the afternoon block on the 19th. That's when we're going to be screening. So, you know, you'll be able to find tickets, you know, at our, on our socials and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do have the domain name for Sky Forest. So at
I
some point we
do.
May build out that actual
I know you
website,
have it.
But we have not yet.
Yeah, I know you have the domain name because I went to it and I looked. This is we're under construction.
Yeah.
So that's
I bought it just in case.
That's why I had to ask. I had to ask.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, this has been an absolute joy to have you on the show today. To finish out 10 years, finish out 2024. I have my fingers and toes crossed for a feature Sky Forest, and that you get into another writer's room, because I do think that that is a perfect place for you to be. I really do, because you have many ideas.
I really appreciate Debbie, and I really appreciate you having me on. It's a huge, huge honor to close out the decade of Behind the Lens. It's really, really just a huge honor, and I'm just thrilled to be here, and it was a lot of fun to talk to you about all this stuff, and I thank you for taking the time and for saying all these nice things about our film and our amazing crew and our amazing cast. Like, this was a passion project for a lot of us, so it's cool to come on here and to talk about it with somebody who's honestly such a veteran in the industry, so I really appreciate it.
And you also know that if I thought it sucked, I would tell you.
I do know that, which makes me feel even better about it.
See, people, you know, when I tell filmmakers, if I say something good about a film and I break it down and this is, you know, this works and why it works, and a lot of people think, oh, yeah, you're just saying that. No, 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 no. I will equally tell somebody, I will say, what were you thinking? And you know this to be true.
I do.
You know, all of you guys know that. I think Jordan has actually heard me say that to some filmmakers before. You know, what were you thinking? Did you see a psychiatrist before you went and did this film. But no, this is so well done. You exceeded my expectations. I'm just beyond impressed, John. Beyond impressed.
Thank you so much, Deb. Thank you so much.
I think Ben should finance the feature film, but that's just me. All right, my friend. Am I going to see you before you head back to see your family for the holidays?
You may. I'm not leaving till next week, so I'll be around.
Okay. Thank you so much, John. All this right. has been a real joy, and I'll see you later.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was John Corcoran talking about Sky Forest, his journey to almost having deals, not having a deal, almost having a deal, not having a deal, being in a writer's room, co-writing a script on a major television show, and now his directorial debut with Sky Forest. All right, well, that is, we went way over today, and I don't think Pam minds because it's the last show of the decade, the last show of the year. So, next few weeks, Pam gets off. She doesn't have to be here. She doesn't have to get up and come in to Adrenaline Radio. And follow me on Blue Sky, X, formerly Twitter, Movie Shark D, also BTL Radio Show, DeBlore on Instagram and Threads, and of course, Behind the Lens on Facebook, and me, Debbie Lynn Elias. So, that is all we have for 2024. Until next time, thank you for being with us for 10 years and for this year. I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.